Well, why don't we start? I think I sent you some questions, right?
You
And
did,
I'm
and
more or
I
less going to go
have them
through
here.
them. So we can start with the very first, which is the question of Anthropocene and death of nature. These are tropes, obviously, that I've pulled out of the media. They belong together only because they appear together all the time, but you might want to tear them apart or tear them apart individually or from each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are connected really closely. I mean, I remember, what was it, 20 years ago when Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, I think it was called, wasn't it,
Yes.
came out. And I thought that was a very prescient book. And, you know, he was just pointing out that there was no square millimeter of the Earth's surface that hasn't been affected and for the most part adversely affected by human beings. And so, you know, one of the senses of nature, I see you ask about that later, you know, in one of its senses, I think it did come to an end. You know, there was no pristine nature left. We've managed to sort of infect or affect everything. And I think now that they're talking about the Anthropocene, and now that you look at what's happening with not just with global warming, but with all the other, I mean, I think especially species extinction and you know, sort of toxic poisoning of waters and earth and so on. Yeah, I mean, I think we humans have you know, are definitely leaving our mark on the planet in a way that is indelible, and most of it not very encouraging for the future. I must say, I remember back in the days in Berkeley in the early 70s, you know, when the Save the Whales bumper sticker started, and I mean, now we're sort of Save the Humans, I think. You know, I think it's that far along. So yeah, I think both of those are, I mean, I suppose I would say instead of death of nature, the end of nature. We haven't managed to kill the natural world yet, but you know, but we certainly infected it sufficiently that it won't be the same again for a long time, if ever.
Well, what exactly ended? If something ended, some kind of nature ended with Anthropocene, or is ending with the Anthropocene, what exactly is that that's ending? And
Well, I think that you had what you had up until fairly recently was fairly large parts of the Earth, but certainly, let's say, you know, certain natural ecosystems that hadn't been affected by humans, and I think we learn a lot from those, you know, people studying zoology and botany and so on. It's a valuable resource if you're interested in knowing how things work, you know, to actually say, okay, here's an ecosystem that hasn't been, that really hasn't been impinged upon by humans. And there obviously were lots of those, and now it's doubtful whether there are any. And yeah, so and you know, that loss I think is on the one hand scientific because it certainly seems to me to be of value to understand how natural ecosystems work, you know, in the absence of our interference. And secondly, yeah, there's a sort of there's an aesthetic loss as well because I remember when I first used to go backpacking in the Sierra Nevada, it wasn't hard in those days to get to a place where you just felt, you know, humans haven't really been here much. You know, they haven't left their mark, certainly. And there was something very, I don't know, healing about that, sort of invigorating, vitalizing. And now that it's all human, you know, all human conditioned, that's a little less interesting. You know, we've definitely lost something there, I think.
You talked about the aesthetic, an aesthetic crisis. in the death of nature. I think we could say death of nature as wilderness for what you're describing. So the death of wilderness or the end of wilderness, and that being an aesthetic problem. Would you want to define that a little more? And how is that not romantic, or is that is it?
Yeah, I know. I know it sounds romantic, but it seems to me. I mean, in my limited experience of coming across various ecosystems, that that there simply is something. You know, when you're in a relatively healthy ecosystem, I mean, it simply does look good, and it smells good, and it tastes good. You know, there's something, I don't know, we're evolved out of those. We're evolved to sort of find them good. But, you know, and I don't know if that's romantic in any bad sense. I mean, I think this is something that, you know, I think when we move from save the whales to save the humans, we're making things slightly easier for ourselves, because we're saying to people, look, you know, what we're doing is we're destroying the natural resource base on which we depend for our existence. But, you know, I don't think we should forget also that, you know, there is that other side to it, that there's a whole aesthetic world there, a world of incredible beauty. And, you know, it's not that hard to access, and I mean, this is one of the reasons I think people don't care very much about it. It doesn't cost anything, you know, to contemplate. You don't have to. There's no admission fee, and of course, you know, with late capitalism, that's not something you want to get people too interested in. You want to sell them something.
Mm-hmm,
have them enjoy something gratis.
I wonder if you would think that this devaluation of the aesthetic, or diminishment of the aesthetic significance of wilderness, has deeper philosophical causes. Is there some way in which we could, as philosophers, help the public understand that this is not a superficial consequence of the death of nature, that the world is aesthetically impoverished?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one, because I think one thing that would work, one thing that would change things, is to simply get people to give it a try. You know, and that's the problem, is that with urbanization, so many people are in cities, and they just don't come into contact with, you know, much that's natural anymore. So there isn't any opportunity to realize how beautiful it is. And if they are in contact with it, they're probably sort of, you know, looking at it through their cell phone camera displays. But I mean, I think also this is not exactly to answer your question, I suppose, but it's relevant that the aesthetic and the, you know, I'm thinking of the Chinese tradition where the Chinese garden is constructed to be an aesthetic delight, but it's also at the same time, it's also a sort of vitalizing environment. It's you know, it charges your batteries. It's designed to sort of make you more alive. And you know, that fellow, what's his name? I don't know how to pronounce his name. It's Louv, Richard Lull, who talks about nature deficit disorder. That's a pretty interesting area to me. You know, that there are studies showing, more and more studies showing that actually, which isn't surprising, that the human body actually does thrive when it has more contact with natural environments than less. And given that we're kind of evolved, you know, in them, I mean, until fairly recently, we were sort of, you know, cheek by jowl with natural ecosystems, whether we liked it or not. And I'm glad that there's now some scientific evidence that that's, you know, that to be deprived of that, to be insulated from that isn't, you know, isn't making us any healthier for sure.
So I think that this is a kind of local notion of nature that we're discussing here. Nature as wilderness, as something that's aesthetically and or maybe even biologically invigorating, intellectually invigorating for human beings. But if you were to then amplify your notion of nature in such a way as to go more global or universal with it, a working definition of nature, what would it be?
Well, I suppose one of them we've been talking about, you know, that part of the biosphere that's not human, that's other than human. And I suppose that's, you know, I've been thinking a lot about Chinese philosophy recently, and I suppose that's heaven and earth in the, you know, in the Chinese conception. I mean, obviously we are also natural beings, certainly as embodied, we're natural. So there's an overlap. But I still, you know, I'd want to make a distinction. I want to keep the distinction that I know is not very fashionable, between the natural and some opposite to it, you know, the artificial, the synthetic, or whatever. I think that seems to me to be helpful. You know, the fashionable thing, I think, is, I mean, you see many people saying, well, but it's all natural. You know, since we human beings are part of nature, then anything we do is natural. Well, if you say that, then you completely empty out the concept. Then it doesn't mean anything. If everything we do is natural, then, you know, there's no point in using it. But it's clear to me that yes, we are a part of nature. We certainly started being nothing but a part of nature, of the natural world, understood as the biosphere before humans sort of managed to part themselves from it to some extent. And then, you know, then it seems to me that you get human beings doing social things, doing cultural things, and so on. And of course, there are animals that are social. Hard to say that there are animals that are cultural, though. I mean, that seems to me to be an opposite to nature that is still helpful to retain. And of course, you can have culture without destroying nature. Those two are perfectly compatible, it seems to me. But I think where I think the really helpful, that nature is a sort of guiding notion, or what analytic philosophers call a normative concept, is really, I think, after the Second World War, you know, when we started being able to produce synthetic chemicals and stuff that had never been on the surface of the planet before, you know, that's human beings creating non-natural stuff, and boy, that makes a difference. I mean, you know, that gives you waste for the first time. You know, something that isn't assimilable by ecosystems. You know, plastic simply does not, you know, doesn't biodegrade, and you know, I think that's a large part of our, I mean, that's been a large contributor, obviously, to the overall pollution of the planet. And a rule of thumb that would say you're better off with natural, you know, making natural things that do biodegrade than these synthetic things that don't, because they really mess up the system.
So I take it you're pretty sure there is an environmental crisis. That was my second question. But I wonder if you might say something a little bit more about how you understand it. What is the crisis?
I mean, I think many things are going on. For me, the crisis, I mean, if we want to make it singular, it's global warming. Because if we don't address that one, then none of the rest will matter, because we'll have thrown the energy balance of the planet off to such an extent that, you know, that everything will be falling apart. So for me, that's the crisis, and it's continues to me to be scary, because it seems like, you know, most people, or enough of the people who count, don't, you know, deny it, or don't seem to care, or don't seem to think that we can do anything about it. But of course, then you've got the other things that we've talked about already, happening, species extinction, you know, toxic waste, pollution of the oceans, the soil, the air. I mean, you know, there's a whole slew of different environmental crises. I think the acidification of the oceans, another big one, you know, that is proceeding apace, and, you know, that's going to cause some real long-term changes. So yeah, I mean, I think we've got crises, several of them, but for me, it's the global warming is the crisis. Mm-hmm. The really serious.
Well, this is a nice little segue into my third question, which is a statement which I'd like you to comment on. I'll just read it out. The environmental movement is driven by the language of action, not speculation. In this context, we see little philosophical reflection on the current situation and its origins. Instead, we are compelled to either give up hope or surrender our fate to big science. Ontologies for a New Earth is an act of resistance to this eco-hysteria.
Can you clarify for me when you say this eco-hysteria? What exactly is that referring to?
It's referring to a situation in which the situation is so dire, the crisis is so immediate, that there is really no time to reflect. Now we need to do something because, you know, our doom is imminent, and generally, what we need to do is something very big, like an exhaust pipe to space, or breed slime that sucks up climate changing gases, and so on.
Yes, I mean, I think you've hit on something, namely, yes, that there is an urgency. I mean, people say there's an urgency to act, to do something. And I think there is. I mean, I'm personally, I've been doing, reading a lot in the climate sciences the last few years, and it seems to me that we've already discharged enough greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, that are to make things very different in a pretty unpleasant way for, you know, in the next few decades. And that, you know, it's not the end of the world yet, but since we obviously aren't going to stop tomorrow, we're going to keep on tomorrow and the next day, just to take greenhouse gases, the more we discharge into the atmosphere, the higher the risk of you know, things happening that will cause chaos, sea level rise, and you know, all the consequences of climate change that the models predict. So I certainly think that we need to do something. I think we need urgently to act. However, I think you're right to suggest that the environmental movement hasn't exactly been a great success since the 60s and 70s. In fact, it's been failing. So it's not been doing the right things. And I think we do need some reflection and some philosophical reflection on what the best thing to do is, how we go about doing it. But I suppose for me, since you're talking about ontology and sort of, you know, fairly deep level philosophizing, there's a question that really does underlie so much of the discourse from hysterical to fairly reasoned, which is the implicit question of, you know, what is the, you know, what is a good life? What are we aiming at? What do we, if we want to do more than simply survive as a race, sometimes it seems people would be happy with that. I mean, I think we should set our sights higher. We can survive, you know, with a fair amount of toxins in the environment. But I'm for you know, not giving up yet, and say let's aim for thriving and flourishing. But you know, that seems a very basic question that isn't often enough asked. You know, what does that mean? How do we understand that? And can we come to some agreement? How do we come to some agreement about the answer to that question? Because it seems to me that what the sort of implicit answer, the implicit assumption there, is that you know. Oh, sorry. Are you having a guest there?
No, no, I'm all right.
Oh, okay. That the implicit assumption is, you know, the good life is, you know, being good consumers and consuming lots of energy and consuming lots of consumer products. But you know, that seems to me rather that doesn't seem to be right. I mean, it's not right for me personally, but doesn't seem to me that those high levels of consumption are in fact making us happier. And I think that one of the big problems we have is that if you say to people, well, we've got to scale back, we in the developed world, we in the rich countries are going to have to consume less, people freak out because they think, my God, we'll all be miserable. But it's not at all clear to me that we'd be miserable. And I mean, this is where issues of global justice come in too, but even aside from those, I would say let's try it out. But sorry, I'm not answering.
No, I think you are. In fact, what you've done is you've told us that we need to think about this as an ethical question in a much larger sense. We're not talking about environmental ethics anymore. We're talking about ethics, you know, in the ancient sense of what is it to live a human life?
Right. And so, I mean, you know, when you say we're compelled to give up hope, I mean, sometimes I do despair, I have to say, some days. Or surrender our faith to big science. I mean, you know, I think we've got it's clear that we've got the scientific, you know, of course, the climate sciences are never going to attain certainty. But they know well enough what we're doing, how the system works, and that if we keep on with business as usual, it's simply going to get worse. We raise the risks of you know, very bad things happening. So, you know, one of the big questions for me is, how do we get that across to the people who deny that there's a problem, or, you know, the people who don't want to change things? Because, you know, there's a lot of studies now showing that telling people the facts doesn't really help much, or rational argument doesn't help. You know, that people's views on this funny term, you know, do you believe in climate science as if it were God or something? But that, you know, that one's belief or the credibility that one puts into natural sciences, you know, is connected rather deeply with one's sense of oneself, you know, who one is, what kind of a person I am. You know, so, I mean, that's something I think for us as philosophers to think about, because, I mean, you know, the first plan of action that we're likely to think of is, well, we've got to give people the facts and speak to them, argue rationally. You know, that's what we're trained to do. But both of those things are shown to not really make much difference. And so, you know, what, I mean, there is this, you know, these interesting studies that fellow Daniel Kahan, or Kahan, at Yale, showing how much, you know, your views on this are tied to your, you know, your sense of your social self and so on. But also people saying, well, you know, what works is narratives, telling stories, hitting people emotionally with images and so on. This actually connects with one of your later questions when you ask about what role does art play?
Mm.
Because, I mean, it seems to me, looking back at the last 20 years and seeing how many things don't work, that what might work, some things that obviously do work to some extent, I think, are things like film. You know, people don't read books much anymore, at least the people that need to be reached on this. They don't read. They do watch television and they do watch film. And I think that, I don't know if it's one of the things that ONE is interested in, but I have a fairly firm conviction that other media than the published word are going to have to play a greater role.
Absolutely, that's exactly where the direction we're trying to open this up into. In the question six, I was thinking about the fine arts, the performing arts. I must say, I wasn't thinking about mass media, but there's no reason why we shouldn't think about it. A film is a great idea. Why not? I mean, just as an aside, I'm thinking of putting together, in Canada, we have something that's analogous to the BBC, which is a very good radio station called CBC. And they have a program called Ideas. So I was thinking of turning this into an Ideas segment, which has quite a few listeners, at least in Canada. But it's, I mean, that's my initial idea, but why not? Let's make a movie too.
Yeah.
If you want to reach people, reach them where they are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think we need to be, I think, you know, radio, television, you know, we really need to realize how limited the published word is, you know, especially when it's published by an academic press or in an academic journal. And I'm interested in you know, the power of, I think, a well-made documentary film is a powerful, that's a powerful medium, but also the drama, the feature film. You know, it's a real challenge, I think, to sort of get these ideas dramatized, or get the, get the situation dramatized. But it seems to me that could be a powerful, powerful one.
I guess my one concern would be is that, you know, just improvising on this theme, we already have a fair bit of eco-catastrophe on the big screen, and it's become, you know, it's become entertainment. It's environmental porn. We wouldn't,
right.
You know, at some point, are we becoming part of the problem when we turn it into entertainment?
Yeah. I know what you mean. That is a danger, and I think one needs to avoid the pornographic aspect of it. But you know, I'm just thinking that the possibility of, I mean, here's a population that interests me is, you know, when you look at the ways that the politics of climate change are getting blocked, one of the big obstructions, obviously, is all the money that the fossil fuel industries are pouring into, you know, disinformation and propaganda and think tanks and so on and so forth, because they stand to lose enormous amounts of money when we switch from fossil fuels to renewables and clean energy, which, you know, at some point will happen. And the question is how soon. So, you know, I can't help thinking of these, you know, I don't usually, I mean, I don't work with the category of evil much at all, or even sort of good and bad. But you know, it does strike me that these are the bad guys, that I suspect that quite a number of them know what they're doing, and they just think, well, but, you know, no, we'll go for the short-term profits and let people figure out the damage a bit later. And so it seems to me that I can imagine I can't imagine it well enough to write it, or I would write it, but I mean, I can imagine a good film script, you know, that has plausible characters that engage each other on, you know, where you sort of get the arguments from both sides or from all sides, whatever. You know, that sort of thing would be a valuable, addition to the things that people are trying to do.
Well, I think we should probably move on to the last question here, which is kind of an invitation for you to, you know, to be as imaginative or as pessimistic or as hopeful as you need to be. And it's a question about the future. What future, if any, do you see for the human species?
As I said, some days I despair, and you know, you've surely heard this too, that people will say, well, listen, you know, human beings are natural. We are naturally evolved. You know, we're not naturally evolved to deal with a problem like the one we've created. That's part of it. You know, we're sort of, you know, we're evolved to be sensitive to or aware of different kinds of dangers, but not the danger of actually frying the planet. And maybe we'll go the way of the dinosaurs and other species that, you know, that were unfortunate and didn't do too well. I certainly can imagine that. But I think we can, it's still worth trying to avoid it. I don't think the Buddhist in me wants to point out the whole damn thing comes to nothing anyway, right? It's all impermanent, so it's all over. But the question is, how is it going to be over? And you know, us being so stupid as a species to you know, to fry the planet that's a rather sad way to go out. So I think we can, I mean, you know, what's obvious is that there is a very clear solution. There is something we can do. You know, we can't do it tomorrow, but we can switch from, you know, we can switch from fossil fuels. We can get to zero emissions. That's possible. It's possible practically, scientifically. I mean, I think the last few reports from the IPCC, especially that one last year on renewable energy, very interesting. But, you know, it can be done. But the question is politically, and the question is political, you know, will it be done fast enough? So on the one hand, I think, you know, we're dependent on the politicians wising up. That's possible, seems to me. It's maybe not probable. On the other hand, I'm thinking you've probably seen people now talking about, well, we're not going to get the right kinds of international treaties, you know, signed in time, whether in Paris or Lima or wherever. It'll have to be done through corporations and business and NGOs and so on and so forth. I'd say, yeah, that's something that should be tried as well. Try that one as well. But yeah, I really don't know. Doesn't look, the prospect looks pretty dim to me, but, you know, I'm sort of, optimistic that we can do something. Whether we can do enough, it's not clear. Or whether we can do enough soon enough, it's not clear.
Graham, thank you. This has been an extremely interesting conversation, and I'm looking forward to continuing it in the near future.